Welcome to A World of Good podcast. I'm Nate Tapman.
And I'm Andrew Gale.
And we are two friends
who love Jesus,
care about the church,
and travel the world to share stories of people who do the same.
Our conversations happen in all kinds of places,
like a coffee shop in an airport terminal,
or even the back of a crowded taxi.
But no matter where we go, from Argentina to Zimbabwe,
we capture stories of the good God is doing around the world.
And we hope those stories will do you a world of good.
Thanks for joining us. This is Nate Tapman and Andrew Gale. Andrew, episode number 2. We are here.
I know. We made it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, we are actually recording this right before Valentine's. By the time you listen to this, it's going to be post-Valentine's. But
yes, it's a very important American holiday, the Valentine's
Day. Yeah. Love is in the air.
Do you have any specific like Valentine's Day traditions that you do as a family or between you and Stacy?
Yeah, actually we, yes and no. So we have a tradition, and what we have done probably, boy, for the last 15 to 17 years or so is Stacy and I actually do not go out on a date for Valentine's. And instead, we take our kids out.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And we started that. I think our two oldest daughters were probably like 5 and 7 or 6 and 8 at the time. But I had a pastor, actually a professor, share with me that they did this. And it was just kind of a way for, as a father, to build that relationship with his daughter or daughters, just to kind of show or to model to his daughters what it would be like to go out on a date with a guy and to do that, you know, kind of properly and to show them, you know, the respect and honor that they deserve and just to be that model for them. So we started that at a very young age with our kids. And so, and we do that to this day. So
yeah, it's a cool tradition.
Yeah. Now I take my 4 daughters out. We usually pick a fancy restaurant and have dinner, and then we will move on to a fancy dessert place. And it's a lot of fun. I'll usually buy them flowers and roses. And
that's awesome.
And then Stacy, she will take our son out, and usually they'll do like movie and a bowling and dinner and things like that. So it's a lot of fun. We get to spend that time with our kids and have some individual time, or at least I guess Stacy and Dylan get to have some individual time, and then I get to have some time with my daughters. So it's a lot of fun.
That's right. That's a big crowd now with 4 daughters.
It is.
That's awesome. That's a really cool tradition. I am Valentine's Day is a lot of can be a lot of stress. I'm a terrible gift giver, so this is not a holiday that is in my wheelhouse, but
So is gift giving not your love language? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. It is not my love language. So don't get me a gift, Nate, for Valentine's Day.
Perfect.
But I'm also just really terrible at it. I know that's like an excuse people use. I get it. I know it's an excuse, but I want to tell you a funny story about a Valentine's Day faux pas.
Please.
This was early on in my marriage. Autumn and I had been married, I think, for maybe a year at this point in time. And I knew that she was really interested in reading some like Thomas Merton, you know, mystic writers. And so I thought, you know, I travel a lot for my job. I thought I'll get her a book that she can read, something that she'd really enjoy. So I went to Half Price Books.
Perfect.
Already a problem, you're doing a good job so far.
You're doing a good job. This sounds good.
to buy a low priced book at Half Price Books, but I thought they would have a lot of selection there. So I found a bunch of Merton stuff, but I wanted one that was like more devotional, not too long, not too, you know, just something she would enjoy. So
what you're telling me, I mean, it sounds like you've put a lot of time into this.
Well, you would think so, but when the day came that I gave it to her, she unwrapped it. I hadn't thought through some specifics. So one of the things that I had not thought through was the title of the book.
Uh-oh.
So on Valentine's Day, my wife unwraps a book that's titled Thoughts on Solitude. So the day that you're supposed to be celebrating, you know, your relationship together, she gets a book that's like, so probably we should spend some more time apart. Like, she was like, what are you trying to tell me with this book? So, yeah, not my proudest moment. I don't know that book has ever been read. It's still on our shelf somewhere. So, Oh, Valentine's Day. Oh, American cultural holiday. So
please tell me that you have made up for it since then.
Well, you'd have to ask her that. I'm sure the answer is no, but I work at it every day. So.
Well, since this podcast is still kind of getting off on its feet, Andrew, maybe just share with the listeners, in case this may be their first time listening, maybe just share with them on where and how they can find a World of Good podcast.
Yeah, we've tried really hard to give as many options for people as possible. So first off, if you want to go to a website, you can go to chogglobal.org, chogglobal.org/aworldofgood, all one word. And there on that website, you can learn about the whole podcast, the show, the hosts, but you can also subscribe and we'll email you then each new episode if you like getting them in your inbox. But that's not just the only place we are online. You can also get connected with us through social media.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things as we get going here, we really want to try to promote and work at building a community around this podcast. And so we will be at Twitter, or we are at Twitter at A World of Good Pod. We are also on Instagram at A World of Good Podcast. And then you can also find us on Facebook through the Global Strategy Facebook page. And again, as we continue to kind of move into this and we get more content, get more episodes going, we will post pictures, we will post backstories, we will also post polls and questions to kind of hear what it is that you guys are interested in listening to, what you're interested in us talking about, or maybe trying to find somebody to interview a certain topic on.
Yeah, and as of right now, when we're recording this, the podcast is available through iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and we're working to get it on other platforms as well. So hopefully about any place that you would want to listen to a podcast, you can access A World of Good. Please subscribe and listen along.
Yeah, so today's episode, we will be sharing part two of our interview with Stephen and Peggy Beverly. They are missionaries to Sri Lanka. And if you missed part one, definitely go back and listen to that as we talked with them about their calling to missions, calling to Sri Lanka. And then you and I got on after the interview and just kind of talked about what it means to be called and working through somebody maybe in a position of trying to field out their calling and what this season of life or this next season of life looks like.
Yep, and you told a great story about professing your love to a Costa Rican cab driver. So someone you should probably get on just to listen to that part of the episode as well.
Yeah, I'm going to have to be careful of my stories now. Because,
they're going to come back to haunt you.
They're going
to
come back. And these are like, they're out there now.
They are.
You know, it's like people can go out and listen to them whenever and however. Yep. So, and however many times they want and use that against me.
That's right. Episode two, this part two of our interview with Stephen and Peggy, we get to hear more about Sri Lanka, the country, and talk about not just the demographics, but the religious makeup of it. Talk about the culture, some of the cultural elements, and then we get to learn about the Church of God and the Church of God churches. So some really fascinating things about whether they're allowed to build churches, you know, the challenges they have just in building facilities, the undercurrent they feel of war that's been a part of their culture, and how Stephen and Peggy are really trying to help create some sustainability in Sri Lanka. So it's a really fascinating episode. Before you listen to the episode, here's my challenge to you. Try to imagine in your mind where the country of Sri Lanka is, because I think that that's one of the things that, it's one of those countries that I think we often misplace. So before you go look it up on your phone or check out a map, try to think about where Sri Lanka is, and then they'll give us a little bit of a mental picture during the episode.
All right, let's jump into the interview with Stephen and Peggy Beverly.
So you guys now are living in Sri Lanka. I mean, that's your life is now, all this journey, you're there. Now, I feel like Sri Lanka is one of those countries that if I asked a room of 10 people where it was, my guess is that 8 of them would tell me they know where it is, and about 2 of them could actually point it out on a map, because it's one of those that we feel like I've heard that before. I feel like I should know where it is, right, but I really have no concept of where it is or anything about it. So give us some background. Where is Sri Lanka? Where is it located? What's some of the uniquenesses about it that are interesting that we would be interested to know about?
It's interesting that once we said yes, we would go to Sri Lanka, we had to look it up ourselves.
Well, that makes me feel better then, right?
Yeah. It's one of those countries where people even have trouble even pronouncing the name. We hear a lot, Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka. So, yeah. But that's actually one of the reasons why it has so many different names is people have difficulty pronouncing it. Ceylon was a mispronunciation of Sri Lanka. Ceylon being one of the older names for the country. But Sri Lanka is an island nation just southeast of India. Some people say it's in Africa. Some people say it's part of India. But no, it's a separate country and just south of India in the Indian Ocean.
Interesting. And tell us about some of the ethnic makeup of Sri Lanka. I mean, one of the things that I think is fascinating as I've gotten to know it is the different ethnic groups that are there and how that's caused, that's a big part of the history of that country. So tell us anything about that story and that history that might help us get to know the country.
Well, Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country. There are two main ethnic groups. One is the Sinhalese, and they're mainly Buddhist. The other is Tamil, and they are mainly Hindu. And actually, it's 78% Buddhist, 18% Hindu, and only 1% Christian there on the island. There's about 22 million people.
Wow. Okay, tell us about the kind of where you are in comparison to the capital is Colombo?
Correct.
Capital is Colombo. It's about 2 hours south of the airport, which they still call the Colombo Airport. But it's off of a smaller town called Negumbo, and we live in that town, Negumbo.
Okay.
And is it's on the west coast.
And is the breakup, the Tamil-Sinhalese breakdown, ethnic breakdown, is it a geographical where, like, in the north is one community and the south is another, or is it spread out throughout the entire island? How does that...
It is very much geographical. There are about 11% Tamil people on the island, and 70% of those live in the north, central, and eastern parts of the country.
Okay. And so where you guys live, what's the predominant ethnic background in your community?
It would be Sinhalese.
Okay.
And what is kind of the makeup of the churches there that you guys work with? How many churches are in Sri Lanka altogether with the Church of God?
That's kind of a loaded question. We work with about 28 Church of God pastors in Sri Lanka. In many of the communities that our pastors are serving in, the communities will not allow them to build churches. So they operate prayer cells or home churches, and a pastor may have 4 or 5 different prayer cells that he will minister to in the outlying communities. So 100 more, at least, prayer cells in the Church of God in Sri Lanka. There aren't very many physical churches that we have there.
And what's the, going back to some of the cultural and ethnic background, I know that there's some history there between those two groups. How does that play into the role, your guys' role, the role of the churches? And maybe just share a little bit of the background of the divisiveness between the two groups.
The British rule ended in 1948, and after British rule, the Sinhalese government took over, and they began a real strong nationalistic focus and focused on the Sinhalese ethnicity. There was a large population of Tamils there as well, and so what they began saying was that the only language was Sinhala that could be spoken or taught in the schools, but in many of the Tamil communities, the school systems taught in Tamil. So there began some friction between the Tamil ethnic group and the Sinhalese ethnic groups, and a war started, and depending on who you talk to, the war started at different dates, but it was about 30 years. And it was a bloody war and basically ended very violently, and a lot of communities were destroyed. So in the church is one of the few places that you find both ethnic groups in any kind of social activity together. Because they're largely separated geographically, it's only when those two ethnic groups are brought together in the church do you find them working together. And that has been an amazing thing to see, that God can cross those suspicions, that can cross those ethnic boundaries, can bring two different cultural groups together to worship and to serve God together. But it also brings some of those tensions and suspicions from both ethnic groups into that community of believers as well. So that's been one of the challenges that we've had to work with there.
Do you know the makeup of those approximate 100 prayer cells in terms of which are with the Sinhalese and which are with the Tamil?
I would say about 85% of our pastors are Tamil speaking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so they would have the prayer cells in the outlying areas.
And give us a, you know, you've shared this story before, and I think it's just really fascinating. But when we think about, you know, ethnic division, we often come in with our own perception of what that looks like in a community, because we it's based on what our experience has been. But you've talked about even when you travel, you know, people, when you're doing border, you know, crossing certain areas, they'll ask you questions to figure out what your background is. Tell us some about that. That I think paints a picture of what life is like in a place where there is the kind of division and suspicion that you're referring to.
It really is unnerving to be traveling and to be pulled over. One trip, we were coming back from the eastern side of the island. I think we were stopped 3 or 4 times within 100 miles by either police or the army, just to ask questions. And they always want to know who we are, what we've been doing, where we're going. And it's a little unsettling for that to happen. But we understand that in the past, during the war, those stops were much more dangerous than they are now. And that people would often be removed or apprehended and taken away and sometimes never seen again when they were pulled over. So there's always still a concern by the government that the rebel faction that had started the war would start back up and start causing more trouble. So the checkpoints are still in place, and not as much as they had been in the past, but they're still there. It's really interesting. We'll be sometimes, even in our community, when we lived in a smaller village going to the grocery store, we were pulled over and we were riding in a small tuk-tuk, a three-wheeled vehicle with no doors, and it's a lot of fun. and the driver, who had carried us to different locations on in past occasions, just started telling the officer who we were, where we live, all about us, and he didn't think we could understand Sinhala, but we were kind of following along. And he was just telling the police our history as he knew it to the officer. And so that's a little unsettling. But we, as foreigners, are treated with a little more deference than Tamil-speaking people might be in certain parts of the island.
And you shared specifically in one of your blog posts about a word that the guards want them to say to try to decipher which tribe they're a part of. Maybe just share that story a little bit.
So that was a story that we were told about during the wartime.
Okay,
the war
so that
ended
was
2009.
That doesn't happen.
That doesn't
now.
Happen now. Right.
Gotcha.
Yes, and it was a way to determine if the person who was crossing the border or crossing through the checkpoint was either Tamil or Sinhalese speaking.
Gotcha. And it was, I mean, translated as the word bucket.
You're right.
But it
Baldia or Baldia. Yes.
Yeah. What they said.
So that's important. I think that's really fascinating. So when we talk about war, again, because of our context, we think long history. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about a war that ended a decade ago.
Right, in 2009.
We're talking about a war that continues. I mean, as with any type of conflict like that, it continues in the minds and the societal interactions.
Absolutely.
There in Sri Lanka. How does that affect the ministry that you do? Does that play into the way that you interact or engage? I mean, is that something that's in the back of your mind every time that you engage with churches or people, or is it just kind of this undercurrent?
To some degree, it's just an undercurrent. It's not at the forefront of our thoughts or our interactions with pastors, but we do have to be careful when we're forming committees or we're forming groups. We make sure we have both Sinhalese and Tamil-speaking people on the committee And even in ministry, when we're bringing one group to another place, sometimes a certain ethnic group won't want to travel through a community that he doesn't speak that language, because they do speak different languages and they don't speak each other's languages for the most part. Wow. But there have also been challenges between different individuals in the church, where one might say something about another person being involved in one aspect of the war, and then that causing problems between those two, and then it beginning to filter out to the other pastors. And so we have to work with the pastors, trying to help them assuage some of their feelings and suspicions and anxieties about what was happening with that. So it just creates a different layer of challenge and ministry that we have had to learn to be aware of, because we weren't that sensitive to the depth and the nuances of those feelings between the two ethnic groups. So we've had to kind of sit back and watch, but then also ask questions. Okay, so why is this pastor upset? Well, he's upset because the Sri Lankan government is still looking for terrorists who were involved in that. And if you accuse this person of being part of that, that's putting their livelihood at stake. Wow. So we didn't understand that until we have to work with our pastors to understand
these things. That's so interesting. It's one of those things, a great example of how somebody coming from the outside, especially somebody coming on a 2-week trip, is not going to have any kind of understanding of that context. Right. And why I think having people like you guys and the work that you're doing on the ground is so vital, because you're building relationship and understanding that allows you to navigate those situations in ways that that you can't do in a short term. It takes time and relationship and trust being built.
Kind of going into your ministry, what is it that you guys do? What are your kind of main responsibilities?
In a nutshell, our ministry is to help promote the sustainability of the Church of God in Sri Lanka. Typically, when people think of sustainability, they think of financial terms. Well, that's certainly one aspect of it. Our pastors, in general, are very poor, and they work in very poor communities, and the communities can't support them. So one aspect of what we do is to try to find ways to help our pastors become personally sustainable, finding projects to help them feed their families and continue to do ministries. But that's just one aspect. Another aspect, actually there are six of them that we kind of envelop into this sustainability image of Sri Lanka, is administration, developing a sustainable administration that can handle growth, that can promote transparency, that can have a way for the church to move forward with a vision and a mission. So that's part of that as well. The national ministry, finding facilities, a way to support, bring in funds locally for national ministry to be done, including youth ministry, women's ministry, and children's ministry. There was no national ministry work being done in Sri Lanka for the Church of God. There were a lot of great local ministries happening, but nothing that was bringing the Church of God together and being and have where they have a national ministry focus. Also, spiritual growth in terms of sustainability, finding Bibles for our communities that they didn't have Bibles in their churches. Wow. Helping our pastors go through some religious education, helping them get their degrees, providing different spiritual training sessions for our pastors on a quarterly basis has been a huge part of that sustainability and growth for the church. Many of our pastors, most of our pastors, are first-generation Christians. Hmm. So they're coming out of Hinduism, or they're coming out of Buddhism, or they're coming out of Catholicism, and they're trying to understand Christianity with that religious background of Hinduism, or that religious background of Buddhism. And so we're trying to lay a strong foundation for our pastors so that they can promote our preach that to their people, so they can teach it to others, so that it becomes more sustainable, and then they can live it out in a community that is anti-Christian.
Do you have that theological training there in country, or is that something you're looking
at? It's in country. We have been doing quarterly training with our leaders and pastors in Sri Lanka.
Okay.
Another part of sustainability is working with our communities where our pastors are serving, trying to find ways to connect our pastors to what's going on in the community so that the communities aren't fighting our churches and fighting our pastors and trying to destroy the ministry that's there. So finding ways for a pastor to connect to their communities, whether it's an after-school program to teach some of the kids in the area, whether it's a shop where the community can come buy bread and milk and the pastor can show that, you know, I am a part of this community, I'm working with this community, and I'm a benefit, and our ministry is a benefit to this community. Or it could be something as simple as providing soccer balls for the school so that this community knows that this church, this pastor, loves this community, is a part of this community, and is working to build a better community here. And then the last part for sustainability has to do with fellowship. When Peggy and I arrived in 2015 in Sri Lanka, the pastors were meeting once a year for a business meeting of, what, 3 hours maybe, and then they would go back to their separate communities. And so they didn't know each other's stories. They didn't know what the situations were in their local communities. They didn't know what their hopes, their dreams, what their strengths, their weaknesses were. They didn't know how to pray for one another. They didn't know how to help one another. They had no sense of a corporate body of the Church of God. They just had their individual ministry and no sense of being a group together, working together. So fellowship has been a huge part of sustainability, bringing the pastors together, sometimes just to sing songs and pray and hear each other's testimonies, so that they can become more unified and become knit together in their hearts and in their vision and in their aspirations as a church.
What have you seen within any one of those different areas that you just shared? What have you seen? What are some stories of maybe growth or where you've seen the light bulb maybe go off with a church or a pastor with some of these areas that you're working in?
Well, on the Preach, Teach, and Live quarterly teachings that we do, we meet with the pastors in an area where they all can come together. And it's 4 days that we spend with the pastors. And we started this in March of 2018, I believe it was. And we've done several different ones. And the first time that they came together was
chaotic.
Very chaotic. It was just like a shouting match. It was... It was almost like they were getting all their frustrations out at one time. It was just really a challenging moment. But as we've gone through the different trainings and teachings, we did one on servant leadership. Mm. Our second one was on the kingdom of God. The third one was on unity and holiness. Then we had one
on absolute surrender.
But by the time we made it to our last one, which was Character of God, which was a year from the time we first started, Stephen and I were sitting there in the midst, and we was just like, wow. Hmm. Can you feel the difference in the atmosphere of where we are? I mean, it's the same location where we've always been. Mm-hmm. But even at each session that we would have, just seeing the pastor so intent and listening and beginning to participate, beginning to help one another more than we had ever seen before was just awe-inspiring. Yeah. And knowing that, God, look at the hand of God working in the midst here. Nothing that we could do, nothing that we could do. But and in these sessions, we would invite pastors from the States to come over and lead these sessions. And it wasn't just for them to teach the pastors, but we wanted the pastors to impart into these leaders who came from overseas too. And that was really rewarding, just seeing the pastors connect with our pastors there, the pastors from here in the States connecting with our pastors, and then them sharing. And change of heart in the pastors there in Sri Lanka, because at the beginning it was nothing to ask, you know, for funds or, you know, to help them or to tell the story that was really hard and it was actually true for them, because just as Stephen shared how poor and difficult things were for them. But then I think they were beginning to see who their true source is, and that's God. And so instead of being aggressive toward one another, they were just really sharing about how God is blessing. And I think beginning to see how we can't depend upon man, per se, for our resources and things, but it's God who is our provider. It's God who opens the door. It's God who is operating in their lives, and that has changed their lives. We would sit, and as the leaders were sharing or teaching in these classes, just how the pastors at first wouldn't really respond, and we couldn't figure out why are they not responding, and so maybe we should ask it in a different way. But they would, we had a couple of pastors said, we've never heard this before. And so it was just sinking in. And we have one pastor who, I can't remember what class or what training it was, but he came back. He was part of our leadership team, and he came back and began tithing to the national leader, to our national ministry, because he got it. Mm. And that's key, even if one gets it.
Yep.
How great that is, and how it can begin to filter down or filter out, however God has it. And, you know, it's just seeing God operate in their lives, touching their lives, changing their lives, so much so that our pastors, and this is kind of a different story, have asked if they could bring their wives to the training, have asked if they can bring their daughters to the training as well. And so that's big. Yeah. That was really big.
Mm-hmm. How prior to that, what was their view on women in ministry? Do they have women as pastors, lead pastors, and that sort of thing?
I know of one.
Okay.
I know that they had, but things have changed through the years. But more and more, it's going in that direction. And we do have several women pastors. One that was just recently brought into the Church of God. Her husband was a pastor and has been a pastor for many years. And she now has her own church as well.
Awesome.
So they both have a church.
Cool.
We have another pastor whose wife, she goes out evangelizing and in areas. It's just like, how did you get here? How did you find this? You know, and because of her ministry and outreach, just going out meeting, and this was in a Muslim community. She's Tamil, and she went to a Muslim community. And from her outreach, a church has been birthed.
Wow.
In an area that is predominantly Muslim, which was, wow.
It's fantastic. Wow, I am just so thankful for the Beverleys and their call and the work to the Church of God in Sri Lanka. One of the things that stood out to me in that interview, knowing the missionaries that I've known on the ground, I know that this was such a huge blessing and opportunity for them to see this in and during their tenure. But I love how they talked about and shared the story of just seeing the culture among the pastors change and bringing them together. From the first time to up until the most recent time they met, and just the connectivity, the fellowship, the networking, the relationships that those pastors are able to build, and for the Beverleys to see some of that fruit from their ministry, immediate fruit from their ministry. I'm happy for them, and I'm so thankful for their impact.
Yeah, and I love how they ended that interview, you know, being able to hear about a female pastor who's planting a church in a predominantly Muslim community. Like, to think about the challenges that she must face, but that she is so passionate about her faith and wanting to share her faith. It's just incredible. It's so encouraging to me to see how, you know, they are really pushing against, you know, some of the challenges that they face and really making an impact where they are. It was really encouraging.
And just so you know, a resource that we will have a link in the show notes for, Patrick Nachtigall. He is the regional coordinator for Europe and Middle East with the Church of God. He and his wife co-lead that region and also the Three Worlds team. He wrote a book, I believe, back in, I think it's 2006 or so. It's called The Passport of Faith. And in that book, he wrote specifically a chapter on Hinduism in Sri Lanka. And so I really encourage you to pick that up, at least to read that chapter, and encourage you also to read the entire book, as it's just helpful of understanding the different religions, from a, you know, around the globe. And so, that will be in the show notes. Andrew, any other last words?
I just encourage people to continue to learn about what's going on in the world, and join us next time for episode 3 as we hear more about the specific challenge of persecution that the church in Sri Lanka faces. Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. Make sure you check out his other songs by searching for Leo Flores Music. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.